Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Christian Ramirez, director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition, who examines what's at stake and how the Supreme Court rules on the constitutionality of Arizona's repressive SB 1070 immigration law. Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network, who talks about how fines that British Petroleum must pay for their massive 2010 oil spill will likely be dedicated to projects designed to restore endangered Gulf Coast wetlands. And Mark Bray, a member of the Occupy Wall Street media team in New York City, who talks about the significance of May Day protests across the U.S. and what's ahead for the movement in the coming months. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Marine Le Pen, the new leader of France's far-right National Front Party, stole the show during the first round of the French presidential election on April 22nd. Major party candidates socialist François Hollande and conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy won spots in the runoff election scheduled for May 6th. Yet it was Le Pen, daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, founder of the National Front with its anti-immigration, anti-European message, that shocked the political establishment by winning a record-breaking 18% of the vote. When he won the French presidency in 2007, Sarkozy received significant support from the National Front, who responded to his tough talk against immigrants and crime, especially in the Paris suburbs, where most North African immigrants live. Now, with persistent 10% unemployment and harsh austerity measures, National Front voters have soured on Sarkozy. Many blue-collar victims of globalization who make up the base of the National Front are hoping Sarkozy loses the runoff election. While Sarkozy has publicly ruled out forming a coalition with the National Front, he has openly appealed for support from the Front's 6.4 million voters in the upcoming election. Pedro Laguna and his family returned to his hometown of Tamalula, Mexico, in the rural state of Guanajuato, after living without papers for 20 years in the southeastern United States. But after the recession hit in 2008, life became difficult when states like Arizona and Georgia imposed tough sanctions against undocumented workers. During the recession, Pedro's wife Silva lost her job at a plastics factory, while Pedro stopped making long-distance truck deliveries during major holidays in order to avoid being stopped by police, since he does not have a U.S. driver's license. Pedro took his family back to Mexico last June, and the Laguna family is not alone. According to the Mexican census, 1 million Mexicans returned to their homeland after having lived in the U.S. from 2005 to 2010. This adds up to a zero net flow of immigrants between Mexico and the U.S., reversing a decades-long inflow. Demographers say there is a complex set of reasons for immigrants returning to Mexico, including the severe U.S. recession, the collapse of the housing market, harsh new anti-immigration laws, and a record number of deportations of undocumented residents under the Obama administration. All this, combined with improved job prospects in rural Mexico, has made life south of the border much more attractive to many. During the early days of the Obama presidency, the White House packed their economic stimulus package with clean technology projects, totaling $44 billion in 2009. Now, federal spending on clean technology has dropped to $16 billion in 2012 and is set to decline further, with little prospect for additional funding from the GOP House. While the U.S. retreats from investing in clean energy technology, China is moving quickly to dominate solar manufacturing, with a majority of workers in America's solar industry now working to install solar panels rather than manufacture them. Apart from the Solyndra scandal, where a recipient of government funding went bankrupt, federal spending on clean energy technology helped double the capacity of renewable energy production from 2006 to 2009, while employment in the sector grew by 12%. Despite all the praise for venture capital's role in developing clean tech, the majority of funding still comes from federal government subsidies. Further, research funding for clean tech has remained stagnant at $4.7 billion a year, only a third of what many industry observers say is actually needed to help renewable energy take off. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments on April 25th from both defenders and opponents of Arizona's controversial Senate Bill 1070 immigration law. The Obama administration's Justice Department is challenging the Arizona law, arguing that the federal government has sole authority over matters of immigration enforcement, citing the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution. Four provisions of the law have been blocked by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Two of the law's provisions criminalize undocumented immigrants found in Arizona who are soliciting work within the state. Another part of the law authorizes police to make warrantless arrests of anyone they believe has committed a deportable offense. The fourth provision is often referred to as the Papers, Please measure, which requires police to demand immigration documents from anyone stopped, detained, or arrested in the state who officers reasonably suspect is in the country without authorization. The law also mandates that law enforcement agencies determine all arrestees' immigration status before being released. Opponents charge that the law will institutionalize racial profiling, primarily targeting Latino citizens and non-citizens alike. During the high court hearing, legal observers saw signals from the questions posed by justices that could mean that the conservative majority on the court will uphold key provisions of the Arizona law. If the law is upheld, Alabama, Georgia, Indiana, South Carolina, and Utah will likely be able to move forward with similar immigration laws that were enacted but have been put on hold pending the Supreme Court's decision. The court is expected to issue a ruling in the case by late June. Your reporter spoke with Christian Ramirez, director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition, who examines what's at stake and how the Supreme Court rules on Arizona's repressive SB 1070 immigration law.
Unfortunately, SB 1070 is at the forefront of anti-immigrant legislation across the United States. This is an attempt by the government of Arizona to take control, they say, of immigration policy and enforce immigration laws because they feel that their state has been affected negatively by the influx of migrant workers, and they have, the legislators in Arizona have taken it upon themselves to enforce their own interpretation of what federal immigration laws should be. Part of that interpretation is that anyone that appears to be an undocumented person will be subjected to questioning, detention, until that person is able to prove that, in fact, they are in this country with documents. This is particularly problematic for a state like Arizona, in which over 60% of the population are people of color. This has become a hot button issue not only in Arizona, but across the United States, because law enforcement agencies, local law enforcement agencies that are not well trained to determine what immigration law is, have now taken it upon themselves to enforce that immigration laws and have, in fact, created very serious problems in terms of civil and human rights in that state. And the threat, of course, now is that that type of state-driven immigration policy will be adopted by other states if the justices in the Supreme Court determine that SB 1070 will stand and will be allowed to be implemented.
Christian, can you tell us a bit about how this law has affected immigrant families and others on the ground in Arizona?
I think the main issue has been the fear-mongering in Arizona. The main driving force behind this bill in Arizona were legislators that were very closely tied to extremist groups. As a matter of fact, Senator Russell Pierce, State Senator Russell Pierce from Arizona, who was the main architect of SB 1070, was recently recalled by his constituents because of alleged misconduct and because of his close ties to white supremacy organizations in that state. What we have created in Arizona is, in fact, a climate of animosity, but we have also seen something that has been very powerful to see, which is communities, not just the Latino community, not just immigrant communities, but communities of all shades and all creeds and all faiths coming together in that state to say enough. We cannot afford in our country to go back 60 years in civil rights gains. We need to hold true our values as a nation, that we cannot discriminate against folks based on their color of their skin. And what we have seen, in fact, is not just folks marching and protesting, but also beginning to mend the wounds that SB 1070 has created. The main issue is emboldening a law enforcement agency that is ill-trained to enforce immigration laws. And because of that, a lot of folks in that state have been persecuted because of the color of their skin, and many immigrants have felt that they are no longer welcome in Arizona and have left the state, even those immigrants that are legally in this country. So it has been a very divisive issue in Arizona, but as I've said, it's not just the fear and the terror that communities feel, but now we have seen a very powerful and very beautiful civil rights movement flourishing in Arizona that I think is perhaps the silver lining of this very contentious debate over SB 1070 in the Grand Canyon State.
It's interesting. I've heard some commentary from police chiefs and other high officials in police departments around the country who really are not favoring this legislation. They don't want this responsibility and all the scrutiny that they come under when these immigration issues are on their agenda every day as they, you know, make traffic stops and all these other minor arrests and then have to go through this extra legal hurdle of figuring out if this person or that person is here and legally documented.
Time and time again, not just in the Southwest, but in my visits to other parts of the United States, I have heard from the law enforcement community the message loud and clear. We, as local law enforcement, should not have to deal with immigration issues. That is something that is exclusive to the federal government to enforce, and states and municipalities should not get involved, because if we get involved, then we will lose the trust of people of color and of immigrants in particular. And that's exactly the debate that's taking place in the Supreme Court.
That was Christian Ramirez, director of the Southern Border Communities Coalition. Find links to more information on Arizona's SB 1070 immigration law on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. British Petroleum's Macondo oil well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico just over 2 years ago was the worst and most publicized environmental disaster to strike the U.S., killing 11 workers and spilling 200 million gallons of oil into the deep waters of the Gulf, as well as the vulnerable and disappearing wetlands along the shore. But there have been many other oil spills over the past several decades, and their impact has been worsened by the steady erosion of barrier islands and wetlands, which are disappearing at the rate of one football field every hour. In all, the Gulf of Mexico has lost approximately 50% of its historic wetlands, and those remaining are under increasing threat. Before Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005, Hurricanes Gustav and Ike in 2008, and before the BP spill in 2010, a project using $14 billion of federal funding was proposed to restore Louisiana's wetlands, but was deemed too expensive and was never launched. Now, with impacts much worse, there's the possibility of action precisely because of the BP oil spill. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Aaron Viles, deputy director of the Gulf Restoration Network based in New Orleans. He talks about the continuing loss of wetlands and the potentially good news that fines that British Petroleum must pay to the federal government will be dedicated to projects to restore endangered Gulf Coast wetlands.
The plans, as you mentioned, are expensive. You know, they were $14 billion before Katrina. After Hurricane Katrina and Rita and Gustav and Ike, they wrapped together the coastal restoration mission with the kind of hurricane protection mission to make sure that our communities were safe, because we know that these wetlands aren't just important for habitat. The most productive fishery in the lower 48 is in Louisiana and is fueled by these marshes. These amazing birds that we saw, the pelicans, you know, that's their key habitat. 2 to 3 miles that a storm surge travels over these intact ecosystems will knock that surge down by a foot. That's why they kind of wrapped in the coastal restoration with the coastal community protection. And then, of course, what that means, though, is the plan gets a lot more expensive. So instead of a $14 billion plan, now they have, the state has this Sustainable Coast Master Plan that expects to or would like to spend $50 billion over the next 50 years to stabilize the coast, to protect communities, and to start building land. We now are looking at real possibility of significant funds to jumpstart that restoration plan because of BP. So the first off, we know they're going to have to pay to fix, you know, the equivalent of what their oil has screwed up within the ecosystem. We know BP has committed $1 billion to this restoration initiative. They will likely have to pay more. It won't all be in Louisiana, but what Louisiana is committing to is basically as much as the money as they can, you know, shunt to the restoration components of that plan, they will do so. And then, of course, the big, huge kind of brass ring for the coastal advocates right now are BP's Clean Water Act fines. These Clean Water Act fines, you know, without federal legislation, would be a windfall to the federal treasury. And because BP's oil release has been historic, their Clean Water Act fine will be historic. You know, instead of the $200,000 that the EPA collects for clean water violations on any given year, we will be talking about billions of dollars, so orders of magnitude higher. And depending on how aggressive the federal government, the DOJ, goes after BP, if they prove gross negligence and they hold them to every barrel that the independent scientists say they spilled, we will be talking about $18 billion plus. Right now there is legislation, it's called the Restore Act, that has been attached to the transportation bill, so they're doing conferees right now, and they will likely include this measure to use 80% of BP's Clean Water Act fines to do the Gulf, large-scale Gulf restoration and ecosystem restoration and community recovery with these monies. So it won't all go to Louisiana's wetlands, but everything that Louisiana gets will go to this marsh restoration initiative and coastal protection initiative. So that could be, you know, billions of dollars that will be put in place, you know, basically overnight to start this process, depending on what the Department of Justice is able to do. So it's kind of interesting because out of this disaster, we have, you know, the best opportunity ever to scale up restoration in a way that will finally begin to be on par with the crisis.
Aaron Viles, if you got all this money from BP, would there also be money coming from the state or federal coffers, or would everybody just say, let BP do it?
Actually, the landmark legislation for Senator Mary Landrieu was the Gomesa Act of a few years back, the Gulf of Mexico Energy Security Act. It actually lets Louisiana start receiving a cut of the federal resources from the offshore drilling. So if folks don't know it, but the, you know, the second largest source of revenue for the U.S. government, second only to the IRS, is offshore drilling lease revenue. Those revenues are very significant. And for the longest time, the adjacent coastal states didn't really get anything out of those revenues. And now the state will be getting about a third of the offshore revenues. That money is all programmed to go into the Coastal Restoration and Protection Trust Fund. That's being augmented by state revenues that are going in there as well. And everything that BP gets from BP will go into that trust fund, so all the state monies. So that's something that's really critical, you know, that there is this kind of transparent and accountable initiative that, you know, the state's going to pony up, the feds are going to be able to pony up, and then BP will be putting a big chunk of that down payment to get things started. Because the Gomesa revenue, that federal lease share revenue, doesn't start until 2017. We are hopeful that, you know, legally BP will be held accountable and that the bigger check will get in there before that.
That was Aaron Viles, Deputy Director of the Gulf Restoration Network. Find more information about Gulf restoration projects by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 7.5 months after the Occupy Wall Street movement was born in New York City's Zuccotti Park, activists across the U.S. and around the world celebrated May Day, International Workers' Day, by taking to the streets in what was described as a day without the 99%. The call for a May Day general strike urged workers to take the day off and students to walk out of school to participate in marches, rallies, nonviolent civil disobedience, and teach-ins. International Workers' Day commemorates a peaceful protest in Chicago on May 1, 1886, where thousands marched for an 8-hour workday. The march was followed by a lethal bombing in the city's Haymarket Square and the unjust execution of 4 anarchists with no connection to the bombing. The May Day holiday is celebrated in more than 80 nations around the world, but ironically, not in the U.S., despite its native origins. On May Day 2012, demonstrations took place in more than 125 cities in the United States, Europe, and Australia, unified around opposition to corporate greed, growing economic inequality, austerity budget cuts, and an embrace of grassroots democracy. Since last fall's police repression and eviction of Occupy movement encampments in dozens of U.S. cities, activists have been reaching out to make common cause with labor unions, immigrant rights groups, and students. The diversity of people who participated in May Day actions suggests these outreach efforts have met with some success in broadening the base of this new movement. Your reporter spoke with Mark Bray, a member of the Occupy Wall Street media team in New York City, who talks about the significance of the May Day protests and what's ahead for the movement.
The popular and, frankly, lazy media narrative is that after we were evicted from Zuccotti Park in November, that was it. It was a passing fad, now back to your regularly scheduled programming. But that's far from the truth. If you looked at our calendar of events throughout January and February, you'd see that virtually every day we have either like a foreclosure auction disruption or an educational workshop or a training or a rally. And so what we've been doing is we've sort of been going back to the kinds of grassroots organizing and coalition building that usually happens before a big mobilization, but in the case of Occupy was sort of inverted because we had all the attention before we had really done the grassroots mobilization. So we're trying to build this into a movement that's going to last into the future and is not just going to be a couple months worth of fad. So that kind of building and coalition work that we've done with the unions and immigrant rights groups is now going to become manifest on May 1st as we march together with thousands of people down Broadway. And what we're also trying to say is that, you know, a movement is not about having thousands of people out every single day. That is unsustainable. If you look at past movements, they ebb and flow in terms of big public mobilizations, but what sustains them is the infrastructure and the organizing and the connection. So we're showing that we're not a passing fad, that we're going to continue strong into the summer, continue our foreclosure campaigns, student debt campaigns. We're organizing what we're calling a summer disobedience school. You can learn protest tactics. So basically we're trying to say that, you know, we're here for the long run.
Mark Bray, what are the goals for the May Day demonstrations? And maybe you can discuss a bit about the success of the outreach that the Occupy Wall Street movement has done in terms of looking toward new allies in the labor movement and the immigrant rights movement, as well as the student organizations around the country.
Right. Well, I mean, there's always something exciting and for some people a little scary about doing things in a very new way. And that's what Occupy has been all about. And I think that for some people, the idea of calling for people to take a day off work, to take a day off school, might sound strange or unusual. But what we're trying to do is bring sort of a fresh angle in terms of how popular mobilizations are arranged and tie into both the tradition of strikes, but sort of in a 21st century kind of context. And so that's, I think, important to keep in mind in terms of how we work with different groups, because we don't want to, you know, supersede the work that other groups have been doing, but instead be sort of a complementary force. And so with the coalitions that we're working with for the May 1st demonstrations, we're both sort of playing our own role to complement each other, because certainly no one group can make the change we want to see on its own. And so we've printed up a new edition of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. We've also, for the first time, made an exclusively Spanish-language periodical for the Occupy movement called Indignación. And I think you can find these things if you Google them on the internet. And so we're trying to broaden the demographics of the movement, get more people involved. But we recognize that it takes a long time to get these kinds of things going, and that we're just trying to take it one step at a time.
Mark, what's next for the movement after the May Day protests across the country? What's the game plan? This is an election year. A lot of significant issues will be raised, and many more important issues will not be raised by the major political parties. What do you see the role of the Occupy movement being over the next bunch of months?
Well, we have some specific events and actions planned. Starting the week of May 11th, we're going to unroll sort of a week of anti-austerity demonstrations and actions, with each day having a theme, one day about education, one day about housing issues, and so forth. We're also organizing an action on the one-year anniversary of May 12th, because a few people remember, but May 12th, 2011, there was actually an anti-Wall Street demonstration before Occupy started. So we're going to have a demonstration on the anniversary of that. We're also, as I mentioned before, I think the Summer Disobedience School is going to teach people in protest tactics training. And then I think a lot of occupiers will go to protest the Republican and Democratic conventions to push our issues in the context of the electoral conversation. And really, fundamentally, there is no sort of climax. We've won, and then we move on. This is a long-term struggle that's going to continue, hopefully, for years to come. And we want to be sort of a constant watchdog and a constant voice of dissent, regardless of who's in office, to try and push the issues that are important to working people around the country. And so as long as we keep organizing and really get people involved on a person-to-person basis, because that's really where political change happens, on the level of the individual and on the level of communities. And as long as we keep doing that, which we're really starting to gain momentum with, then I think the future looks bright.
That was Mark Bray, a member of the Occupy Wall Street media team in New York City. Find more coverage and analysis of the Occupy Wall Street movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Hannah Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.